Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and in this segment we're going to continue our analysis of the historical background to not only the current crisis in the former Yugoslavia, but in particular to the profound American bias against the Serbs and in favor of the Croatians, who are, frankly, to a large extent, simply a recapitulation of the Croatian fascists of the Ustaše regime in World War II. That bias is not only a political one, but also a media one. In our last segment, after examining some of this bias and some of the realities concerning the complexities of the current crisis in the former Yugoslavia, we examined the extraordinary brutality that was manifested by the Ustaše fascists, allied with Nazi Germany in World War II, to Serbs, Gypsies, and Jews. Some 700,000 Serbs were ethnically cleansed in the most brutal fashion in World War II. And at the conclusion of our last segment, we were taking a look at the World War II career of a fellow named Andrei Artukovich, the number two man in the Ustaše regime, the interior minister, under whose supervision the extraordinary brutality and exterminations took place. What we're going to look at next, from the same book that we were examining in the last part of our previous segment, is the post-World War II career of Andrei Artukovich. The book we were examining is a book called Wanted, The Search for Nazis in America. That was authored by Howard Blum, published in hardcover by Quadrangle of the New York Times Book Company, and copyright 1977. As we're going to see, the American World War II attitude, or World War II era attitude, towards people like Andrei Artukovich underwent a dramatic transformation with the onset of the Cold War, when the United States turned to fascists and Nazis as allies against the Soviet Union and communism. This is described in One of the Search for Nazis in America by Howard Blum, in a segment that describes not only Andrei Artukovich, but also some of his sympathizers and fellow operatives in the United States, and in particular, his brother John, who appears to have prospered considerably from the reversal in American attitudes towards the Ustaše and other fascists. But these hearings were promising because they revealed an important clue, a clue about an alliance that would influence the future of Artukovich's life in America. By the way, these were deportation hearings. The clue lay in the identity of certain character witnesses who testified in Artukovich's behalf. These witnesses were agents of the FBI. Only 10 years ago, the FBI had opened a, quote, secret classified, unquote, file on Artukovich's brother John, then a struggling Pittsburgh contractor. The FBI and the OSS were concerned about John's connections with fascist and Ustaše agents in the United States and his prominent membership in various Croatian independence committees. But now, in 1951, the FBI and both Artukoviches were allies in a new war, a Cold War against communism. Conceivably, the alliance might even have first begun toward the end of World War II. As Tito's partisans advanced, the OSS operations in Yugoslavia under the direction of Pittsburgh investment banker Joseph Scribner, then assistant chief of the OSS Special Operations Branch in Washington, were beginning to be motivated more by a fear of the communists than of Hitler. Yugoslavs hired and trained by the OSS were abruptly discharged because of suspected political sympathies for Tito. And once the war was over and dismissed as history, FBI and CIA agents were eager to recruit old enemies as new friends. John Artukovich seemed to prosper just as, perhaps coincidentally, he and his brother acquired these new Cold War friends. He moved from Pittsburgh to Los Angeles and became a successful contractor. His work consisted primarily of municipal and county contracts. For example, a $1,089,935 Los Angeles County flood control project and an $891,614 contract for laying the joint outflow sewers from Bellflower to Whittier. According to some sources, the Artukovich Construction Company also did work for the Seal Beach Naval Station just down the beach from Andrea's bungalow. The Department of Defense, however, denies this. It also remains undetermined whether John's new friends in government helped his company obtain these lucrative municipal contracts. Yet it is certain that the discreet phone calls the FBI or the CIA could have initiated to discourage these contracts were never made. The Artukovich Construction Company grew to be one of the largest in the Los Angeles area, employing nearly 700 workers, and John Artukovich's wealth began to be measured in millions. As we shall see, the pro-Ustashian fascist shift of the United States during the Cold War permitted the Ustashi to thrive in the United States, and in another deportation proceeding against Andrei Artukovich, he was acquitted largely because of a tremendous amount of funds that flowed to his defense, and also because of character witnesses called on his behalf who had previously served the Ustashi regime. We read about this in Wanted, the Search for Nazis in America. This from a Mr. Danielson who oversaw the proceedings against Andrei Artukovich. The problem was we didn't bring into court any live witnesses. Perhaps that was my big mistake. This was only an extradition trial, though. We thought we would save the eyewitnesses for the actual murder trial. Artukovich's lawyers didn't wait. They brought in all kinds of witnesses. They flew them in from around the country, from Europe and from South America. Where they got that kind of money, I just don't know. Maybe his brother footed the bills. One thing is certain, though, a lot of money was spent to keep Artukovich a free man. A lot of money that just seemed to come from nowhere. End quote. Danielson's gravest tactical error, however, might have been his reluctance to challenge Artukovich's witnesses. Besides being expensive to transport to Los Angeles, the witnesses had other common bonds. Each was either a sworn Ustashi, an Ustashi sympathizer, or a fugitive wanted for war crimes in Yugoslavia. Consider Artukovich's character references. René Herman, who under questioning described Artukovich as a benevolent administrator. Herman was a sworn Ustashi, the personal secretary to the son of a Pavlich cabinet minister. Tomiko Mesic, who lectured the court that, quote, the murders were actually committed by the communists, unquote. He was a contributor to Ustashi newspapers. The Reverend Stephen Lakovich, who called Artukovich, quote, a great citizen who could never kill a human soul, unquote. The Reverend, having sworn the Ustashi oath, served as an Ustashi army chaplain. The Reverend Charles Camber, who came from Buenos Aires to testify that, quote, no one person could be held accountable, unquote. Camber had served as an Ustashi prefect of police, swearing the Ustashi oath and wearing the uniform. Yet each of the witnesses' testimonies went unchallenged. The court was left to believe the witness acted as an impartial observer. And still more about the efforts on behalf of Andrei Artukovich and the cover-up of his situation that took place. Once again, reading from Wanted, the Search for Nazis in America. But appealing the decision will be rather difficult. There are, it seems, complications. In the 15 years since the extradition hearings, the transcripts of all the court proceedings have mysteriously vanished from the federal archives in the Los Angeles suburb of Bell. The 130 Yugoslav exhibits and affidavits are gone. No one knows who stole the transcripts, or even how the crime was committed. All that remains is a large manila folder marked Artukovich with the word, quote, missing, unquote, written in capital letters next to the case number. Inside, the folder is empty. Like the entire Artukovich affair, all that remains is suspicions. Well, as we will see, not only the mysterious theft of the Artukovich court proceedings file, but also the mustering of tremendous amounts of money and Ustashi veterans as character witnesses at his extradition hearing, none of this should come as any surprise, because as we are about to see, and as we've also seen to a certain extent in a miscellaneous archive show entitled The Nazis and Anti-Semites on George Bush's Campaign, the support for Andrei Artukovich was characteristic of a very, very important program that we also examined in detail in Radio Free America program number 37, How the United States Lost the Second World War, specifically in the August 23rd, 1992 installment of same. We dealt with the Crusade for Freedom, an illegal CIA domestic media operation, which not only helped to introduce Third Reich strategic thinking into the American political and national security establishments, but which also permitted U.S. funds to be channeled toward what the authors were about to examine termed the Fascist Freedom Fighters Program. Basically, Third Reich and other European fascist veterans were employed by U.S. intelligence as guerrilla fighters against the Soviet Union and other communist countries. And beyond that, and even more importantly, many of these Nazis and Eastern European fascist collaborators were imported into the United States for political purposes, where they were viewed as important elements in the various Eastern European ethnic population groups in the United States. And in particular, they were settled in areas where there were large concentrations of Jewish voters to counteract the Jewish voters. This again took place under the auspices of the Crusade for Freedom and also an intelligence body called the Office of Policy Coordination, which was intended to facilitate and coordinate CIA covert operations. It was one of the central elements in the importation of fascists and Nazis into the United States for political purposes. We're going to examine not only the importation of Eastern European fascists, but in particular the pivotal role of the Croatian Ustashi in this particular fascist milieu. We are going to be turning, for our information, to a very important book entitled The Secret War Against the Jews, subtitled How Western Espionage Betrayed the Jewish People. That book was co-authored by John Loftus, L-O-F-T-U-S, a former military officer and Justice Department investigator with the Office of Special Investigations, in charge with investigating Nazi war criminals in the United States, and also Mark Ahrens, an Australian investigator. The book was published in hardcover by the St. Martin's Press in 1994. In this particular discussion of the fascist element in the Republican Party and how it came to get into the United States, we're going to examine several names which loom large in post-World War II American politics. The godfather of the fascist freedom fighter program, as the authors term this, and also the importation of fascists and Nazi collaborators into the United States to act as ethnic leaders, and as we shall see, these became an important element of the Republican Party. The godfather of that was Alan Dulles. The actual importing of the Nazi war criminals and the political recruitment program was run by Richard Nixon, later, of course, President of the United States. As we shall see later, one of Nixon's cronies in helping to formalize the participation of this Nazi element of the Republican Party in the early 1970s was George Bush, then head of the Republican National Committee. Later, as we saw in the aforementioned miscellaneous archive show, Nazis and Anti-Semites on George Bush's campaign, Bush utilized many of these same elements for his 1988 campaign. As we are going to see also, the spokesperson for the Office of Policy Coordination and the spokesperson for the Crusade of Freedom, under whose auspices the Fascist Freedom Fighter Program and the domestic Nazi resettlement program took place, was Ronald Reagan, later, of course, President of the United States, with George Bush as Vice President. As we shall see also, one of the key officials involved with the Fascist Freedom Fighter Program and the importation of these Nazis and war criminals to serve as a political element in the Republican Party was none other than William Casey, who later, of course, became Ronald Reagan's campaign director and was Ronald Reagan's director of Central Intelligence for most of Ronald Reagan's administrations. Of the importation of Nazis and fascist collaborators, and in particular the Croatians into the Republican Party, the authors write as follows. By the way, also note very carefully the April 10th holiday. That is a Croatian fascist holiday that celebrates the Third Reich's invasion of Yugoslavia in World War II and the consequent establishment of the, quote, independent, unquote, Croatia. Loftus and Ahrens write as follows in The Secret War Against the Jews. As chairman of the Republican National Committee from 1972 to 1974, Bush may have been one of those who knew that there was something politically explosive about the Vatican-Nazi connection, especially as it applied to the Croatians. The Croatian connection to Republican electioneering was no minor scandal, no mere footnote to the 1940s. The Croatian Nazis reached to the very heart of the Republican Party's 1972 campaign to re-elect Richard Nixon as President of the United States. Just about the time that Bush was taking over the job as party chief, the U.S. State Department gave the Australian government a briefing on the role of the Croatian Nazis in American politics. David Sadleir, S-A-D-L-E-I-R, who is now the Director General of the Australian Security Intelligence Organization, equivalent to the head of the FBI or Britain's MI5, met with one of his American counterparts. Sadleir then wrote a long memo on the Nixon administration's sensitive handling of Nazis among the Republican Party's Eastern European emigre supporters. Sadly, they had been told in strictest confidence that in the United States, the fascists had to be coddled because the, quote, emigre vote was important to several municipal, state, and federal office bearers. Accordingly, the Nixon administration needed to exercise care in its handling of extremist groups. As the memo makes explicit, there is no doubt that Nazis were the, quote, extremist groups that were so, quote, important, unquote, to the success of the Republican Party's election campaigns. Although Bush is not mentioned, it is clear from Sadleir's memo that the Republican leadership had taken precautions to hide its campaign association with fascist groups, particularly the Croatians. Sadleir was told by his State Department counterpart that, quote, prominent, unquote, federal, state, and municipal American politicians were discreetly advised by the Nixon administration to stay away from Croatian gatherings on April 10th, because that was the day they celebrated Hitler's establishment of Ante Pavlović's, quote, puppet state of Croatia, unquote, an artificial nation under the complete control of Nazi Germany. There are grounds to suspect that George Bush may have been among those who knew of Nixon's Nazi secret. In the first place, Bush was one of the few people whom Nixon trusted completely. In the second place, Bush's position as head of the Republican Party made him the logical person to take control of the program to warn other Republicans that they must avoid attending Croatian functions on April 10th. While there is no direct evidence that Bush had personal knowledge of Croatian fascist activities, at least before he became CIA director, it seems unlikely that Bush, as head of the Republican National Committee, could have remained out of the loop entirely. The Croatian election connection almost became a scandal during his tenure as party leader. In 1973, a large number of Australian intelligence documents were tabled for parliamentary debate and thus became open to public access. Buried in this largely unread stack of counterintelligence, police, and immigration files was a copy of Sadler's secret briefing memo. The Nixon administration was distraught. No wonder Angleton was publicly furious with the Australians. The Croatian, quote, crown jewels, unquote, were a potential political bombshell. Unfortunately, the indolent American press missed the story completely. The truth was quite sordid. With the help of the Dulles Angleton clique, the Vatican had sent many of the Eastern European Nazis to Western countries, including the United States, Australia, and Canada, where the right wing recruited them to get out the rest of the Eastern European ethnic vote. The man who ran the political recruitment campaign in the United States was Richard Nixon. The cover-up had been going on for a long time before Angleton censored the Vatican files, but the Australians inadvertently had let a tiny corner of the story out of the bag. Although we explore the Republican-Nazi connections in chapters 10 and 13, it is important for the reader to understand the size of the scandal that Angleton was trying to bury. As a young congressman, Nixon had been Alan Dulles' confidant. They both blamed Governor Dewey's razor-thin loss to Truman in the 1948 presidential election on the Jewish vote. When he became Eisenhower's vice president in 1952, Nixon was determined to build his own ethnic base. Vice President Nixon's secret political war of Nazis against Jews in American politics was never investigated at the time. The foreign language speaking Croatians and other fascist emigre groups had a ready-made network for contacting and mobilizing the Eastern European ethnic bloc. There is a very high correlation between CIA domestic subsidies to fascist, quote, freedom fighters, unquote, during the 1950s, and the leadership of the party's ethnic campaign groups. The motive for the under-the-table financing was clear. Nixon used Nazis to offset the Jewish vote for the Democrats. In 1952, Nixon had formed an ethnic division within the Republican National Committee, quote, displaced fascists, hoping to be returned to power by an Eisenhower-Nixon liberation policy, signed on with the committee. In 1953, when Republicans were in office, the immigration laws were changed to admit Nazis, even members of the SS. They flooded into the country. Nixon himself oversaw the new immigration program. As vice president, he even received Eastern European fascists in the White House. After a long, long journey, the Croatian Nazis had found a new home in the United States, where they had reestablished their networks. In 1968, Nixon promised that if he won the presidential election, he would create a permanent ethnic council within the Republican Party. Previously, the ethnic division was allowed to surface only during presidential campaigns. Nixon's promise was carried out after the 1972 election during Bush's tenure as chairman of the Republican National Committee. The Croatian Ustashis became became an integral part of the campaign structure of Republican politics, along with several other fascist organizations. Shortly after Australia released its Croatian memo, Nixon was forced to resign as a result of the Watergate scandal. At the same time, Bush was transferred from his post as head of the Republican National Committee to the CIA. According to the, quote, old spies, unquote, George Bush, a very likable fellow, was appointed head of the CIA partly because his good reputation in Congress would help to fend off any more congressional inquiries, particularly Elizabeth Holtzman's ongoing investigation of Nazis in the United States. The last thing Bush or the Republican Party needed was an expose of the very origins of Angleton's Croatian Nazi connection. By the way, that refers to James Jesus Angleton, longtime CIA counterintelligence chief. Continuing. There was a real risk in the 1970s that the congressional investigations of Nixon might collide with the congressional investigations of Nazis. Bush was sent to the CIA to ensure that Nixon's garbage remained buried. as we're going to see now, when Nixon became president, he formally coalesced this Eastern European fascist group into an element of the Republican Party. 20 years after the birth of, returning to the secret war against the Jews, 20 years after the birth of Israel, the Nazis were coming out of the closet in the United States. One of the most prominent Eastern European fascists was Laszlo Pastor, P-A-S-Z-T-O-R, the founding chair of Nixon's Republican Heritage Group's council. During World War II, Pastor was a diplomat in Berlin representing the Arrow Cross government of Nazi Hungary, which supervised the extermination of the Jewish population. Skipping down. Pastor labored on the fringes of the Republican Party's ethnic division during the Eisenhower administration, but the loyal fascists were always dropped as soon as the election campaign was over. The ethnic division was allowed to be active only during presidential campaigns. In 1968, Nixon changed all that. According to Pastor, Nixon personally promised to establish a permanent ethnic organization in the Republican Party if he became president. Nixon kept his promise. As discussed in Chapter 5, the 1972 secret Australian memo revealed that the Nixon administration had discovered that fascist groups were useful to get out the ethnic votes in several key states. Nixon needed the Nazi vote to avoid another Dewey debacle. Just a few more votes would have made all the difference in Nixon's race against Kennedy in 1960. In several key states, the Eastern European vote could provide the margin for victory in 1968. The road to temptation was clear, and after Nixon won, he approved Pastor's appointment as chief organizer of the Ethnic Council. Not surprisingly, Pastor's, quote, choices for filling emigre slots as the council was being formed included various Nazi collaborationist organizations, unquote. The former fascists were coming out of the closet in droves, and as we shall see, one of the people who was instrumental, apparently, according to many of the sources that Loftus and Ahrens relied on, one of the people instrumental in helping to cement this permanent Nazi division of the Republican Party, and I mean that quite literally, including the Croatian Ustashi, was none other than George Bush, returning to the secret war against the Jews. The most intriguing of Bush's early connections was to Richard Nixon, who as vice president had supervised Allen Dulles' covert planning for the Bay of Pigs. For years, it has been rumored that Dulles' client, George Bush's father, was one of the Republican leaders who recruited Nixon to run for Congress and later convinced Eisenhower to take him on as vice president. There is no doubt that the two families were close. George Bush described Nixon as his, quote, mentor, unquote. Nixon was a Bush supporter in his very first tilt at politics during his unsuccessful run for the Senate in 1964 and turned out again when he entered the House 2 years later. Skipping down. It was Bush who fulfilled Nixon's promise to make the, quote, ethnic emigres a permanent part of Republican politics. In 1972, Nixon's State Department spokesman confirmed to his Australian counterpart that the ethnic groups were very useful to get out the vote in several key states. Bush's tenure of as head of the Republican National Committee exactly coincided with Laszlo Pastor's 1972 drive to transform the Heritage Groups Council into the party's official ethnic arm. The groups Pastor chose as Bush's campaign allies were the emigre fascists whom Dulles had brought to the United States. It seems clear that George Bush, as head of the Republican National Committee in 1972, must have known who these, quote, ethnics, unquote, really were. Columns by Jack Anderson and others had already made it clear in 1971 that Nixon was a little too close to the fascist groups. The Nazis for Nixon problem was one of those scandals that Bush inherited when he took over the Republican National Committee. Skipping down, as head of the Republican National Committee, it seems likely that Bush did have, quote, full knowledge, unquote, as did Richard Johnson of the State Department, that the ethnic fascists were being coddled because the ethnic groups were useful to get out the vote in several key states. As we shall see, or as we're about to see, in addition to Richard Nixon and George Bush, both of them obviously, eventually presidents of the United States, in addition to Allen Dulles, later CIA director like George Bush, two other key politicians were involved with this very same program. One of these is Ronald Reagan. Skipping down. In the U.S., in a footnote in The Secret War Against the Jews, in the U.S. National Archives, there is 1950s newsreel footage of a young Ronald Reagan asking for donations to the Crusade for Freedom. This organization was later acknowledged as a covert front for the distribution of funds to the OPC's network of emigre fascists. See John Loftus, The Belarus Secret, Alfred A. Knopf, 1982, pages 107 and 141. In essence, Reagan's public crusade raised less than 1% of the funds. The rest came from CIA covert accounts that had been laundered through the State Department. The money was distributed to Radio Liberty, Radio Free Europe, and the Institute of Russian Research in Germany. All three organizations had Nazi war criminals on the payroll, as CBS's 60 Minutes program documented in 1982. So Ronald Reagan was, of course, one of the spokespersons for the Crusade for Freedom, under the auspices of which many of these Nazi war criminals were put to work for the U.S. government, and some of them imported under the Richard Nixon-supervised Nazi resettlement program in the U.S. One of the people critically involved along with Richard Nixon and Alan Dulles and Ronald Reagan in this operation was William Casey, who later, of course, became Ronald Reagan's campaign manager and CIA director. In another footnote from The Secret War Against the Jews, we find Bill Casey, who later became CIA director under Ronald Reagan, also worked in Germany after World War II on Dulles' Nazi Freedom Fighters program. When he returned to New York, Casey headed up another OPC front, the International Rescue Committee, which sponsored the immigration of these fascists to the United States. Casey's committee replaced the International Red Cross as the sponsor of Dulles' recruits. Confidential interviews, former members of the OPC, former members, by the way, this information was from confidential interviews with former members of the OPC and members of the British Foreign and Commonwealth Office. So again, we see three eventual presidents of the United States and three eventual directors of the CIA, the presidents being Nixon, Reagan, and Bush, the CIA directors being Bush, Dulles, and Casey, being involved with this particular program to import Nazi war criminals into the United States and put them to work for the government as well as the intelligence services. The Croatian Ustashes were one of the key elements in that particular program. With the Eastern European fascists and collaborators having formed such an important part of the Republican Party, and indeed with people ranging from Richard Nixon and Alan Dulles to George Bush, Ronald Reagan, and William Casey being deeply involved with these elements, including the Croatian Ustaši, it is not surprising that the policy bias, as well as media bias, on the part of the United States towards the Serbs and on behalf of the Croatians should be manifest in the way that it is. In our next segment, we're going to examine more about the influence of this Galen Third Reich milieu on the Ostpolitik, so to speak, of the Reagan and Bush administrations, because indeed these forces did manifested themselves in a big, big way in the 1980s, not only in what used to be Yugoslavia, but elsewhere as well. Those of you who are interested in pursuing this information should check out some of the archive shows. Those are available from a tape duplication service called Archives on Audio. They can be contacted at 415-346-1840. Note also that those of you who have access to the World Wide Web can access the information about Archives on Audio, including descriptions of all of the archive shows and cross-references with other programs containing similar or related material, plus a suggested reading list and other sources. You can access that on the World Wide Web as follows.
Attention, fellow humans wielding exquisitely different and stylish pocket protectors. Please be so inclined to now access those devices, for soon pertinent information will be divulged. Your oh-so-local Silicon Valley cutting-edge broadcasting station, KFJC, 89.7 on your FM unit, is now accessible via the World Wide Web. Isn't that just so convenient? This URL goes as follows. http://www.cygnus.com/KFJC. Once again, all in lowercase letters, and for clarification, that is http://www.cygnus.com/KFJC. Check it out.
Again, KFJC, the home base station on which I do these programs. That concludes this segment. My name is Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.